Early December, 1979. Almost a month ago, students and protesters broke into the American Embassy in Iran. They took the employees and foreign nationals inside hostage. This was in the middle of the Iranian Revolution, but it was also the beginning of the longest hostage crisis in history. The Iranian students had released 13 hostages, but there was no escape for the other 53. Watching it all unfold from the safety of the Canadian embassy were six Americans: Mark and Coral Lijic, Joe and Kathy Stafford, Bob Anders, and Lee Schatz. Sheer luck had helped them escape their initial capture, but every day they spent hiding in plain sight was endangering themselves and their Canadian hosts.
The longer we stayed, the greater the odds were that something like that would happen. I had the sense anyway that Washington had sort of forgotten about us.
Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top secret military operations.
Tony introduced himself as Kevin Harkins. He started off, I think, very businesslike. He said he had come there to take us out.
I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special forces missions to learn about the brave soldiers and operatives who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives. With six diplomats under house arrest for long enough, the CIA sent for the skills of professional extractor Tony Mendez, known for his elaborate plans and expert forgeries. His plan to get them out?
Nobody would create a fake Hollywood movie. And the irony is that it actually worked, and it saved the lives of these people.
This is Argo, Escape from Iran, Part 2. At this point, the American public was furious with their government that civilians were still hostages. And while the original hope was that Iran would step in and do something about it, the hope was beginning to fade. It had been over a month. The State Department staff grappled with how to deal with the embassy. Matt Baglio, author of a book about Argo, explained that while they were aware of the six diplomats, their attention had to be elsewhere.
They knew that they had made into the care of Canadians, but again, they were feeling like they were safe. So they needed to focus on the larger group.
Instead, the rescue of the six fell to the CIA, to one CIA operative in particular. In early December, a series of top-secret flash cables arrived on the desk of an intelligence officer named Tony Mendez. A flash cable is the highest priority of communications. Most operatives go their whole careers without seeing one.
Tony saw these cables on his desk, and at the top of them were these marked flash, which you almost never see. So he realized that this was very serious, and he began getting together with his team and looking at what they needed to do. So he went to a meeting at the State Department, and they discussed what they thought they should do to help rescue these people. And Tony immediately sort of let them know, in a nice way, that they should let him and the experts of the CIA worry about this. And they did.
Over the previous 18 years, Tony had carried out more than 100 undercover rescue operations, extracting assets out of dangerous places.
His job was getting people out of tough spots, rescuing people from dangerous areas. Tony has come back to Washington after being stationed abroad. He's been made the chief of disguise, and this is the department within the CIA, actually underneath what's called the Office of Technical Services, the OTS. These are the gadget makers of the CIA. These are the people in the film James Bond, which would be the Q. Although in the real world, in the real CIA, they actually go out in the field and in some cases use this equipment themselves.
Tony and his OTS specialists set to work on a plan that would get the diplomats out in broad daylight. There were just a few problems to sort through. First, the escapees were American, with American paperwork, and the Iranian authorities would be on the lookout for any Americans trying to leave the country. Second, the six diplomats had little to no spy training. Any plan that relied on them acting or remembering fake identities would have to be very simple. Ideally, it would involve them saying almost nothing. But the main questions Tony had to answer, if the six diplomats weren't American and hadn't worked at an embassy, then why were they in Iran? Why do they speak English? And why do they need to leave? Tony decided immediately that their best bet was pretending to be Canadian. Now, Canada, like most countries, has a law that prevents them just giving out passports to anyone. But, Matt Baglio explains, Canada had a stake in this rescue as well.
Tony goes to Ottawa to basically ask the Canadians for permission to use Canadian passports. Now, they didn't realize that before they had gone, the Canadians were actually already working on this themselves. They were being proactive. They had come to the same conclusion. The foreign minister, along with the prime minister, got together, and they were able to sort of circumvent the parliament so that they could pass this exception to their laws.
The paperwork came together with little resistance. Now, for the cover story. Tony's team, along with the American State Department and the Canadian Embassy, spent days thinking of ideas. The diplomats were teachers looking for work, or they were oil workers trying to find a drill site.
None of them were really clicking for Tony. So he wanted to come up with a story that would not only plausibly work, but would also excite these people and could get them to buy into it, and therefore make their disguise that much more convincing. In this case, Tony realized that he had to go the other way. He wanted to create a story that was so unbelievable, so crazy and over the top, that no one would believe that it was fake.
Suppose the six diplomats were part of a Hollywood film crew, and they were on a special trip to scout filming locations. The revolution in Iran was still in full swing. Regardless, the cultural sector of the government was still interested in attracting foreign currency, and foreign currency included investing in films. This was all well and good, except that Tony Mendez was a CIA agent and had no experience in Hollywood film crews. But someone who did? Oscar-winning makeup artist John Chambers.
So he called his friend John Chambers to find out if it would be feasible and what kind of people would go on a location scouting party. And after Chambers ticked off the various jobs that a person would have, Tony realized that it was a perfect solution. The size of the group fit and the makeup of the group fit, because the challenge was also that you had six individuals ranging from the age of in their 50s down into their mid-20s. In Tony's mind, only a Hollywood location scouting party would be crazy enough to go to Iran in the middle of a revolution to shoot a movie.
Tony spent several weeks prepping the situations, building necessary backstory, putting together costumes, and any other details that would make the story seem more plausible. Once in Iran, he planned to be out within days. Hey, operatives. I wanted to talk a little bit about one of our sponsors this week, ForHims.com. It's a wellness brand for men. One of the things that I really love about this, and you heard me talk about it last season if you tuned in, 66% of men start losing their hair by age 35. I've already started losing mine a little bit thinner on the back spot, and, you know, it's embarrassing. Part of the problem is that men are too proud to kind of do something when you have the chance. When's the best time to handle hair loss? It's when you still have some. And instead of turning to some kind of snake oil or, you know, gas station counter supplements or anything like that, why don't you go to a place where you can get advice and help from people like licensed physicians, and you can use FDA-approved products to help treat your hair loss. Listen, not everybody can look cool bald. It's a choice. My choice? I want to keep my hair. I know most of you do too. So, order now. My listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last, and subject to doctor's approval. See the website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy somewhere else. Go to forhims.com/covert. That's forhims.com/covert. forhims.com/covert. At the Sheardown house, Mark Lijek and the other five Americans were anxiously anticipating their promised rescue. And on January 19th, it finally arrived.
Two gentlemen in trench coats showed up, which was appropriate, of course. Tony introduced himself as Kevin Harkins. There was another gentleman with him, but he stayed in the background pretty much.
Tony arrived with a fake name and brought one for each of the diplomats as well. With him was a man known only as Julio, a translator who spoke Farsi. The house guests were worried. Could this man really get them out of Iran, and how? Korolejczyk said that after introducing himself, Tony launched straight into reassurances.
When we first met Tony, he was very convincing in talking with us. He's a very charming guy, and he did this little sleight of trick, hand trick, with two wine corks, and he linked his fingers and said, "I'm going to get you out of Tehran, like, one, two, three," and he had the corks apart. And I know it was just a trick, it was just a sleight of hand, but somehow I was kind of amazed by the little hand trick. I thought, well, he could do this, and he's saying he's got all this experience, so I think that we can trust him.
Tony made his own assessment of the diplomats in return. The plan would only be as strong as the weakest link, so he laid out the three possible escape scenarios, all while watching them for any signs of hesitation or resistance.
The Hollywood scenario impressed me from the beginning because I thought it was appropriately audacious. I liked the fact that people from Hollywood are a little disconnected from reality, so if you're going to talk about trying to do something like scout a location during the course of a revolution, it's credible that people from Hollywood might actually think they could get away with it.
There was a vote taken, and five of us thought it was an excellent idea. We could go along with it. It would work. Joe Stafford was not, I would say he was not enthusiastic about it, but he didn't put up a strenuous objection. Anyway, so we told Tony then that let's go with the third plan, the film company plan. And so then we got busy and making more definite preparations. Tony instructed us then that we had to learn the identity of another person. We had aliases, different names, of course. So he had prepared for us another biography. He had another name, another place of birth, where you went to school, where you worked, and so we had to learn a new identity. He had a few little physical props, I think, and suggestions on what to do, how to look a little different. We couldn't look too different because we had to look like our passport photos.
Part of the reason it was good is that it involved an element of humor, and I think it was important for us to stay relaxed, to not get too worked up about it, and I also felt that it was something kind of uniquely American.
It was also pretty clear that the Hollywood scenario was the scenario Tony had been hoping they went with. He had spent the weeks prior setting up not only a fake backstory, but fake documents, business cards, receipts, and other pocket litter. He even went so far as to create a fake studio.
One of the key factors in this whole story was that and a good selling point for our buying into the plan was that they set up an office in Hollywood called Studio 6.
Tony's already decided he's going to call it Studio 6 based off of the six Americans that are hiding out in Iran. So the first thing they do is we need to find office space. And after a day of calling around, they get a suite of offices on the old Columbia Pictures lot, which is Sunset Gower Studios. And in 2 days' time, they have a running office with a placard, everything Studio 6 Productions.
Tony gave out their aliases, their names and roles within the studio production, and the CIA had done its homework. They made sure all of the information the diplomats had to remember were things they could easily recall. Cora Lijek, for instance, was told that she would be the Hollywood scriptwriter, Teresa Harris.
Someone had obviously read our files because my birthday was my mother's month and day, and it was my year. So it was things that I already knew. And I actually went to school with a woman named Teresa Harris, who shares my actual real birthday. And the same with Mark's biographical information. He had my dad's first and middle name, my dad's birthday with his year. So it was things that I already knew. So if someone asked, you know, I could respond immediately.
And they gave us business cards. It's like any. So if I there was an address and phone number on there, and if I gave it to someone and they called that number, there was somebody actually there in Hollywood. If they asked for Robert Baker, that's my business card. Robert Baker is the location manager. So if I gave someone that card, they call that number, there was someone there in Hollywood saying, he's not here right now.
Tony had gone all out on making sure this looked real. Everyone had a business card and props. The passports they were issued had previous stamps in it, so they looked used. They even used a real movie script found by John Chambers.
So Chambers has a script based off of a Roger Zelazny novel called Lord of Light. And a famous comic book artist, Jack Kirby, has done the illustrations already. The financing has fallen through. The movie's in turnaround, as they say. It's not being done. They'd envisioned this massive theme park called Science Fiction Land, all these interesting science fiction robots and all these kind of things. So John Chambers had all of these in a portfolio, and he hands them to Tony. And Tony says, this is perfect. This is exactly what we need. It kind of has a Middle Eastern feel to it. We can't call it Lord of Light. We have to come up with our own title. What are we going to call it? And that's when Chambers sort of wryly suggested, let's use Argo. And they realized that it also has a kind of, mythical connotation. Jason and the Argonauts, it's the ship that the Argonauts sailed on. And Tony says, this is perfect. So they have now a script. They have a title for the script.
Tony described the movie as Buck Rogers in the desert, coming to Iran, which has adequate supply of desert would be reasonable.
Now, inside Iran, Tony had a few last touches to make the plan work. He had to forge the travel documents of the diplomats. This would make it look like they had entered the country as their fake identities. Tony was assisted by New Zealand diplomat Richard Sewell and Ken Taylor, in whose office they doctored the documents. The task was simple but critical. If they didn't get these visas right, the whole operation wouldn't work.
At one point, Tony gets the stamp to put in the visa. It's a specialized ink that the OTS techs back in Washington have figured out with its fluorescent qualities and everything. Well, it's dried up. It doesn't work. He walks over to Ken Taylor's liquor cabinet. He selects a scotch with a high octane quality. He pours some scotch onto the pad. He picks up the damper, he stamps it, and he begins stamping the passports. And sure enough, they come out perfect.
January 27th, 1979, the final day of the escape preparations. By January 29th, they would either be home safely or captured as spies.
Well, so on Sunday night, Tony goes back to the Sheardowns to meet up with the house guests to see if they've done their homework. And he's very surprised by what he sees. You know, not only have they come to accept the Argo cover story, but they've actually embraced it. And some of them, very excited about their chance to become Hollywood insiders.
Bob Anders, I think, won the prize, though. I mean, he decided to become very flamboyant.
We just had the clothes on our backs, basically. So the Canadians gave us some luggage and some odd pieces of clothing to make us look like regular travelers. So one of the things that I got was a shirt. It's about two sizes too small. And then as I said, Tony was emphasizing the fact that you have to take on a different identity or a different person, want to live the part. So I got this shirt. It only buttoned up to about here, and then it was open like this. So I'm looking out of my shirt, and And I have sort of a hairy chest, so I was thinking, you know, we got somebody else, and says, we're Hollywood types, and I thought, well, maybe if I had some kind of a chain, you know, with a medallion or something, and that would fit, you know, that'd be sort of Hollywood-ish. And so then I said, yeah, that's the me, that's the new me, you know, that's Robert Baker, that works for Studio 6, you know, so... And then I got the rest of my disguise together. I had sunglasses, I had dark glasses, and I hadn't had a haircut for about 3 months, so I had long hair, like combed it down over my forehead and over my ears a little bit, and I wore my top coat and just sort of threw it over my shoulders a bit like a cape. And anyway, so that was my disguise. I was sort of a Hollywood movie type, at least what I thought was a Hollywood movie type anyway, so.
They only had 2 days to prepare their roles, so Tony needed to make sure they really had them down pat. Roger Lucey, the embassy secretary, donned camouflage and instituted a mock interrogation.
And so we went through, said, you know, we said, you know, who are you, what's your name, and so on and so forth. So we had a little practice at doing it, so. But Roger, he was playing his role as the interrogator. He was playing it to the hilt, so he gave him some kind of a very serious threat. I forget exactly what it was, but something like he was going to be taken away and probably executed, and so something like that. So, I mean, and this gave us all a little start. You know, said, well, we have to take this thing seriously, you know, and... It's not just a game that we're playing. But I personally felt that the plan was so perfect.
The group gathered for a last dinner to send off in style. After 2 months of living with the Canadians and each other, they would now be going their separate ways. Tomorrow, they would pull off an amazing caper, or they would become prisoners. Hey, I want to take a second just to talk a little bit about Bespoke Post. Boxofawesome.com is one of the coolest little things that you can do for yourself, especially if you're super busy like I am. I don't often find the time to really kind of upgrade my life, you know what I mean? I sit in a booth all day and I sweat and I record and I really don't even have time to think about how I can make my gear or my clothes or even my appearance better, because I'm behind the camera, folks. Let's not fool ourselves. I got a face for radio. So one of the things that I love about getting these boxes of awesome is that they're so unique and they're so different, and they're a lot of things that I would never think about getting for myself. My favorite is the concentrate box. It's a cold brew coffee press. I love cold brew coffee. It takes a lot of the bitterness out of the coffee and the acid and adds a really nice kind of zing to the middle of your day. I really want you to take a peek at boxofawesome.com. Go answer a few short questions that'll kind of help them get a feel for the boxes that'll best go with your style. And really treat yourself, man. Receive 20% off your first subscription box. Go to boxofawesome.com and enter the code COVERT at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code COVERT, for 20% off your first box. Bespoke Post. Themed boxes for guys that give a damn. Monday, January 28, 1980. The group arrived at the Tehran airport at 4:30 a.m., with Tony at the lead of the 6 diplomats. Now, there really was no turning back.
We woke up at 3:30 in the morning, having gone to bed about 1 o'clock. We heard Lee shots running down the hallway screaming, "My head, my head," so we didn't even need the alarm clock to wake up. And, of course, we got dressed quickly, washed up, of course, and tried to make sure we didn't smell like alcohol still from the night before.
The night before we left, we stayed up quite late. We had quite a bit to drink, and we only slept for about 2 hours. So when I woke up in the morning, I still was a little bit numb, which I think was a good way to actually go to the airport, because I, you know, didn't really have time to be nervous and be thinking about what was going to be happening. I had to get ready and get ready to leave for the airport. So, you know, it was later when we got to the airport that I felt nervous because I had not been in a public place in almost 3 months, and all of a sudden we're in a crowded airport.
The early morning crowd would help them pass unnoticed. But more importantly, early morning at the airport meant there were less armed guards on staff, and the shift had just changed over. The clerks on duty were tired and still waking up.
So it looked like a good day for an exfiltration, I guess. To me, anyway.
The group easily passed through bag check-in as they parted with their luggage. But the next step was immigration, where they faced their first big test, getting through passport control.
Lee Schatz ran off. He wanted to be first. He was first out of the bus, and he was first to check his bag, and then, of course, Tony and the rest of us were still waiting to process through Swissair, and he'd already bolted down toward immigration.
Lee broke away from the group, against the plan. He was eager to get through, but something was wrong.
And Lee was sort of standing there, was a little nervous. He was beginning to look around, you know, a little worried.
The customs official spent a while looking at Lee's passport, eyes darting between the man and the photograph.
When I saw Lee being questioned, I couldn't hear what was going on, but I saw him pull down the corners of his mustache, so I assumed that the immigration inspector was questioning whether it was him in the photo, but then he had a little trouble. I guess his mustache was a different length than in his photo, so he was going like that, you know, trying to show the guy that he was the same person.
And the immigration officer looked at him, looked at his photo, you know, sort of did a double take, and then took his passport and left and went into a back room.
From a distance, Tony watched without staring too much. He hoped Schatz wouldn't panic. Then the official came back.
So he waited there for a while. The customs agent came back out. And he sort of looked at Lee's mustache. And in the picture, Lee had more of a Yosemite Sam big swooping mustache. And he trimmed it. And he basically told the guy, well, I trimmed my mustache. It's just me. And he said he pulled a very serious face and he tried to match the photo. And the guy said, yeah, okay. And he stamped the passport and he let him go.
The rest of the team filtered through the first half of immigration easily. But they weren't done yet. They still faced the riskiest part of the escape, presenting their departure forms. Tony had forged the yellow exit forms. In a normal case, there would be another half of the forms, a white half that was filled out coming in to Iran. The immigration officers were supposed to cross-reference the two forms, but for the six Hollywood executives, the white forms didn't exist. Tony and the CIA had been monitoring the airport and noticed that the forms were rarely cross-checked. But if the officials did try to cross-check the forms against each other, it would all go wrong. It was a risk, but they had no choice but to take it. When the team approached the counter, no one was there. In front of them, wide open, was the departure lounge. They could likely just walk right past without detection.
But the question was, did we need a stamp from this guy, this non-existent immigration agent? And we figured, yeah, we probably did. So it would be a bad idea to bypass that station. So Cora went kind of in the back there and started yelling for this guy. We didn't yell out and nobody came, so she went and went behind the counter a little bit and yelled again. And this sleepy-looking guy came out carrying a teapot. And he put the teapot down. He grabbed our passports, pulled the cards out, stamped the passports, handed them back to us, and didn't even look at us at all at any point in this process. And we thanked him, and then we headed off to the departure lounge.
All the checkpoints had been passed. They had made it to the lounge. And there were only 20 minutes left until their plane was set to depart. They should be boarding any minute now, except...
Swiss Air Flight 363 will be delayed due to mechanical problems.
When I heard the announcement that the Swiss Air flight was going to be delayed by 3 hours, I was rather upset. I did not think that it was a specific concern for us in the sense that somebody had figured out that we were there, but again, it just meant that we would be sitting there for extra time, which raised the possibility of somebody recognizing Joe or Kathy or Cora in particular.
But also knowing that sometimes when airlines say 3 hours, it could turn into 5 hours or 6 hours. And so I was pretty concerned.
A delay was just more time for them to panic and more time for them to be recognized. As it got later, more guards came into the airport, and these guards were specifically trained to look out for spies.
The bad thing was that we were traveling under false passports, which is what spies do, which technically, I suppose, made us spies, and therefore, if we'd been caught, we could have been punished or dealt with much more severely than the hostages.
The diplomats had no idea if the guards were coming on to normal duty or if they were suspicious of something. Were they looking for Americans or just suspicious people? Had any of them slipped up? What if they were staring at the guards too much? And when it came down to it, would they be able to hold their stories together in front of the real Comité?
It is true that every second felt like an hour. Yes, it was. We just wanted to be out of there. Having completed everything we could do, there was. It's almost worse than when we still had things to do, stations to go through, because it's totally out of our hands. We're just sitting there waiting for that bus, and we can't do anything any longer. Nothing left to talk about. Just wait is all we could do. And you feel very powerless, and that makes the time drag even longer.
Mark remembered that the CIA had given them more than one set of plane tickets, just in case the first ones didn't work out or they somehow missed the flight. The group had a quick huddle to discuss the option, but they decided it would look too weird. Besides, they had already made it through customs once.
For one thing, we were already in that departure lounge. We didn't even know if they'd let us out. And secondly, even Hollywood types probably don't travel with two sets of tickets. And we'd already sent our baggage off to Zurich, and now we were going to send ourselves to London? I mean, it just didn't make sense. So we realized it wasn't an option.
It was now almost 7 a.m., and the lounge was filling with people. Matt Baglio says that with the crowd growing larger, the guards were starting to hassle people.
And the departure lounge itself is filling up. And as the day is getting, as the day is progressing, more and more Revolutionary Guards are coming in. They're beginning to harass the people. Of course, they're looking for Iranians who are trying to steal wealth and leave the country, but they're starting to turn and look at foreigners as well.
After over 100 undercover exfiltrations, Tony knew that unexpected moments like this were the most dangerous. It was the most likely time for them to panic. One member of the party was especially nervous, the one who had not wanted to go with this plan.
One of the people in the group really didn't want to leave. He felt we were abandoning the hostages, and we tried to convince him that we didn't help by staying. We really needed to go. He never really got into the story and the role, and in fact, when we went to the first waiting room, he called me by my real name. And I turned to Mark, and I said, he just called me Cora. And so Mark and I moved away from that person and decided to kind of keep a distance from them, because they obviously were not even, mentally in the role, and that was kind of scary.
He was nervous. And so he picked up a newspaper nearby to calm himself. A newspaper in Farsi.
Tony knew that this person was not very excited about leaving, and later on, he actually picked up a Farsi paper and was reading it, and Tony went over to him and said, put the paper down, because we're just casual visitors from Canada. You should probably not be a Farsi speaker or be able to read it.
They couldn't afford even those tiny mistakes. They were exactly the kind of slip-ups that the Revolutionary Guards would be looking for. Just one glance at the wrong moment, and they would all go down.
Those last 30 minutes in the waiting area seemed to drag on forever, every minute passing very, very slowly. I knew 30 minutes wasn't a long time, but it felt really like forever. I don't think we were talking very much. We'd kind of gotten quiet. We'd done everything we could. We just wanted to get out of that room and onto the airplane.
If if you could take your blood pressure at each different point along the line, it'd probably be pretty high. If we were caught again at the time, we would join the rest of the hostages.
Finally, at around 8:30 a.m., there was a second announcement.
Swissair, flight 363 is boarding.
Quickly and quietly, the group got up with the rest of the crowd and made their way towards the gate. The airport in Iran didn't have any jetways, so they boarded a bus that would bring them to the plane.
And an interesting little thing, we got to the out to the plane, and Swiss Air has a name for all their aircraft. And we got out to the plane, and I saw the name of that particular plane was Argo. A little different spelling, like it was A-A-R-G-E-A-U, whatever it is. But I remember I was standing next to Tony at the time, and I poked and I said, "Hey, you guys really think of everything, don't you? Every detail, you know." So, but anyway, then we got on the plane, and that went off pretty smoothly.
Flight 363, the Swiss plane named Argau, took off that morning on its way to Zurich without further incident.
To me, that was the success point, is when the beverage carts come out, because the beverage carts signify that we're out of Iranian airspace and they can serve alcohol. We ordered some Bloody Marys and we kind of toasted each other, Cora and I, and then Tony was sitting further forward and he leaned out into the aisle and raised his glass and we toasted him back. And when we landed in Zurich, I felt it was over, really. I mean, there were two gentlemen from State Department there to meet us, and they took our stuff, the documentation that we'd been given, and I'm not even sure we had a chance to shake hands with Tony and Julio. They went off, and you know, for them it was just another day at the office, I guess, but obviously for us it was a life-changing experience.
The plane landed in Switzerland, and the diplomats made for their second planes to go back to the United States. Tony and Julio, their jobs done, left.
I wanted to say thank you and goodbye to Tony, but when I turned around, he was gone.
The Argo escape plan, also known as the Canadian Caper, was an immediate news story. A film was made the following year about the Canadian embassy aiding the escape. Eventually, in 1997, the CIA revealed its involvement.
The problem with Argo is that you can do it once. You can't do it twice.
Yeah, I mean, Argo is a perfect example of truth being stranger than fiction. I mean, it's hard to imagine that this is real. It seems impossible, but it's real. And I think that was the genius of Argo. Tony realized that he was going to create a cover story that was too impossible, to believe, so that you would have to believe it. Nobody would create a fake Hollywood movie. And the irony is that it actually worked, and it saved the lives of these people.
Well, I think it's amazing that John and Zina Sheerdown, the Taylors, all the Canadians in Tehran put their lives on the line to help us.
After 2 months in a hostile country under house arrest, the six diplomats were finally free. They were out, but the rest of the hostages had a long road ahead of them of negotiations, failed rescue efforts, and finally, of release. It would be almost another year before the crisis was over. No one had died, but their time in Iran had been far less luxurious.
We really had no way of knowing how the hostages were being treated. We assumed not well. But when those 13 made it to the States and they were able to talk to the media, they revealed some pretty horrifying things: mock executions, lack of food, isolation, beatings. They were treating, especially the Marines, were being treated badly. And we had to assume that this was typical of what the others were experiencing.
The crisis had further consequences for both sides of the conflict. The United States broke off all diplomatic relations with Iran, closing its embassy in Iran, and vice versa. And the failed rescue mission is widely thought to be a key factor in then-President Jimmy Carter's loss for a second presidential term. The Canadian Caper was one of the only successes of the entire crisis.
The whole plan, I think, my view of the whole plan is that it wouldn't have come off without what the Canadians did and what the CIA did. They all did their parts, and it all worked out very successfully. Our little group of six, we were basically, we got a lot of attention and a lot of hero treatment, but we really didn't do anything. The Canadians and the CIA were the heroes, and also the real hostages who were back there. They were real heroes. We were just lucky. We made some lucky decisions, made some lucky choices.
In the next episode, a plane full of vacationers was taken off course by a group of mysterious hijackers. As the plane traveled all across the Middle East and Europe, they were tailed by the special forces of Germany and England. It was the first mission for the German GSG-9, and so they were determined to succeed.
GSG-9, cracking force, but really very little operational experience. But the SAS were developing all these skills from Northern Ireland and from other little terrorist incidences around the world. And I guess GSG-9 thought, yeah, look, let's have these guys on board. Let's have an observer team on board to see, you know, if they can help us out. And I think it worked well for them, didn't it?
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley, Rachel Jacobs, and Karen Bevan, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had additional production help from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.